I'd like now to welcome to the program Liana Lopez. She's producer and co-host of the radio program Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say. It's on KPFT, which is a Pacifica station in Houston. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you are involved with something called Libro Traficante. You're on a caravan to smuggle banned books into Arizona. What's going on?
Nuestra Palabra is an organization who's been around in Houston for 14 years, and we used to organize a major Houston book fair at the Convention Center, and we've been doing that for 10 years. And it was the Edward James Olmos Latino Book and Family Festival. During that time, we made friends with a lot of Latino authors and a lot of distributors, a lot of publishers, and when we heard about the book ban that was happening in Arizona, we, of course, had interviews on our radio show. A lot of the authors on that list were personal friends of ours that had been to the book fairs and at the showcases we used to host when they would come through town with their books. But really what happened was we had read that the books in the Tucson Unified School District that had been banned had actually gone and been taken out in the middle of class in front of the kids, in front of the students, after 2 years of fighting to keep this program, which upped their graduation numbers from the typical 50% that you tend to see around the country for Latinos to 80 or 90%. They had been fighting for 2 years to keep the MOS program in the school system. The Mexican American Studies program, when they dismantled it in Tucson, the legislators that dismantled it made the teachers go into the class in front of the students and take the books out of the class. And it was very traumatic for students that had been fighting for 2 years to keep the Mexican American Studies program in Tucson intact. So it was a message to the kids. It wasn't a very nice message, and it offended them. It offended us because they're going after kids now. And it's different, you know. I know for us, it was a personal assault because of the books and because they were taking education away, and our nonprofit is all about education and literature, specifically Latino and Mexican-American literature. And we had to do something, and it was just a natural reaction for us to say, you know, we're going to take the books over there, and we're going to get in a caravan. And within 2 months, we've organized a caravan that's going to have stops in San Antonio, El Paso, Mesilla, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Tucson, Arizona. We just have networks and friends along the way that made that path. And we are bringing books, and we're bringing attention to the students that are going through this horrendous situation in Tucson. And they have stood up for themselves, having class walkouts, making sure, you know, trying to do as much as they can. And those students need our support. And really, that's what this is all about, is the students that are fighting for their own rights, that right now can't vote. They're not, you know, 18 yet. So they need adult support. What was amazing about this whole thing is, you know, in typical protests and movements with young folks, a lot of times you see that you think that the adults are the ones that have to push them to recognize their rights and to do things like that. These children, these students are doing it on their own. And that really spoke to us, on top of the fact of the book bannings and the folks that were being banned were our friends. What was even more important was that these students were standing up for what they believed in on their own. And we need to support that.
Let's talk for a moment about that law. So the Arizona legislature, which is the same legislature that passed all this anti-immigrant legislation, actually passed, I mean, it seems like something out of another era, passed a law banning specific books, and there's a whole list of specific books, and saying that people can no longer participate in Mexican studies program. What was their intention? Like, where did that come from?
You know, I can't speak for the legislature. I only know what it looks and smells like. And it's pretty interesting because some of the feedback that we're getting or some of the flack that we're getting is the House Bill 2281 didn't technically ban books. And the Tucson Unified School District has hired a PR firm to try to put a spin on that. They first said that the books weren't, there was only 7 books that were banned. But what the superintendent actually said was any books associated with the Mexican American Studies program are not going to be able to be taught in this class anymore. If you Google it, you'll see that the superintendent has actually said the books are not banned, they've just been put in storage, but they're available in the library. And for us, fine, you want to say they're not banned, how are they in storage and how are they available at the same time? You don't want to call it banned, you want to call it censored, you want to call it prohibited, that's fine. Alcohol was prohibited in the 20s. That seems like a ban to us. You want to, it's getting to the semantics, but what they're trying to do are stop the teaching of books that would teach the overthrow of the government or build resentment toward a certain class of people or focus on one's own, I guess, race or identity. And right now they're going after the Mexican American Studies program because it's the way I see it, it's the most effective program getting folks to graduate. And it's a template. If you look at the immigration laws that passed in Arizona and then how bad they got, that template got by the time they were being passed in Alabama, the lawyers that are fighting to keep Moss in the school system have told us the legislators have been bringing this up for 2 years, and finally they perfected it to make sure that Moss is dismantled. But the thing is, what people need to understand is it's starting here. Mexican Americans, right now, Mexican Americans are an easy target because of all of the anti-immigrant things that are going on in the country. But once that happens, they're going to come after African American studies programs. They're going to come after Asian American, Native American. All of those programs are going to be targets next. So we need to stop this legislation right here, right now.
Some of the people on the list of books that were taken out of the classrooms and put into storage or put wherever they were put include books by Howard Zinn, Sherman Alexie, Jimmy Santiago Baca, Sandra Cisneros, Dagoberto Gilb. So much. Shakespeare is one of them. Is that true?
I think they've recanted the Shakespeare one. I've heard, and I really haven't read, but I've heard they've recanted. But yes.
Yeah, The Tempest.
The Tempest was on the list.
Luis Alberto Urrea, half of these people have been on this radio program, wonderful authors. Rudolfo Anaya, one of our favorite New Mexico authors of all time, his book Bless Me Ultima is on this banned book list. Now, as you say, the students are responding with a lot of energy, and the teachers, I guess, are supporting them as well. What does it look like in Arizona, in Tucson specifically?
Well, in Tucson specifically, I know that the teachers have been trying to legally go about getting the Moss program back in effect. It is unconstitutional, and really that's what we're fighting here. But by the time that it goes through the legal system, we've lost a whole generation of kids. It's going to take 4 to 7 years for the law to be recalled the way that it stands right now if we have to go through the Supreme Court, which means that we've lost a generation of children that are going through high school during that fight.
So you are involved with this Libro Traficante caravan, which I love. It's a play on narcotraficante. You're smuggling books into Arizona. What does it look like? Who's involved with the caravan? What are you doing?
It is kind of the old crew that was organizing the book fairs. We haven't done a book fair in about 2 years, so it's almost like recalling memories of the book fairs that we used to organize here that at the height drew 35,000 people to the George I. Brown Convention Center over a 2-day period. So it's the same organizers that have been around and done experience that way, but there's also the Libro Traficante High Tech Aztec, which is Brian Paras. Brian Badas, with his caravan experience, led the way for us to even think about having a bus and going to these different cities, as they did with the U.S. Social Forum Caravan. And as we were building to find out what cities we would go through, we realized the networks that we've had with all the authors along the way. In fact, just a kind of a short, kind of funny note, El Paso wasn't even a city we were going to do an event in. We were actually just planning at first to go to the Cinco Puntos bookstore that's there in El Paso. When we had posted the schedule online, we got some feedback about, you know, why are you guys not having an event here? You know, we'll help you plan it. You guys need to stay here and do something. And they did. The community in El Paso got together and helped us organize an event, and now we're having a Band Book Bash event there as well. And along the way also, one of the things, one of the focuses that we're doing, in four of the cities, we are establishing underground libraries. And basically what these underground libraries are is the goal is to get a set of the banned books in those libraries in those cities so that, you know, our literature is not going to be at the whim of political fights anymore. It'll be available to the youth. And these organizations that we have chosen in the four cities are organizations that are already established, that already have youth that either make up the organization or, you know, that are already there. And so there are organizations that have already been established in the youth, so they're not trying to go and find the youth to come there. They already know about it. And these books won't ever be at the mercy of any kind of a governmental ban. They'll be available to our youth, and our history will be available there.
Tell us about Albuquerque in case any of our listeners want to go to the event on Thursday.
So Albuquerque is really awesome. Of course, you know, all the events are really awesome, but the National Hispanic Cultural Center was one of the first entities that came up and said, you know, a lot of these authors have been part of our writing program, and we want to make sure that, you know, you have a great event. And so they stepped up, and we will be having our Banned Book Bash at the National Hispanic Cultural Center at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 15th. And everybody is more than welcome to come. There'll be readings. There'll be books for sale, banned books for sale. And you can buy books and keep them for yourself, or you can buy books and donate them to the underground libraries that are going to be around the nation along the Southwest.
I love the irony of this, which is that it's highly likely that a lot of these books will be read and known by more people as a result of the book ban than they would have been otherwise.
If you ask any author, they'll tell you, banned books, that's great. It brings more attention to the books. It makes their books even more popular. In fact, just to give you an idea, Carmen Zofala is an author that's on the banned book list. She's based in San Antonio, and she actually has a book called Curandera that was out of print. Once it became a banned book and we decided to go on this caravan, one of the publishers, Wings Press, decided that they were going to start publishing this book again specifically for the caravan so that we could take it and distribute it when we go. So you're right. A banned book is not necessarily a bad thing. There's a list now of Latino authors and writers and Native American authors and writers that have been banned. They've picked them out for you, and there's your history.
I think it goes so deeply to the heart of an essential conflict in our nation, which is that we are a nation of immigrants, but there's some kind of weird dominant, or maybe not so dominant anymore, but mentality that wants us to forget where we came from.
Right. And, you know, what's really sad about what's going on here is the way that this is going down. It does seem like they want the students to feel like other and not part of the United States. There's a lady out there named Lupita Garcia, who's a PhD, and she's been filmed on YouTube telling the students that if they want to study Mexican history, they need to go back to Mexico. And what makes me so upset, one, is the woman is a Latina, two, she's a PhD, but it's not Mexican history. These authors are American authors. The books are in English. the history is the Southwest. It's Texas, it's Arizona, it's New Mexico. And we are a part of America, and it is history, it is United States history. And that is what's so offensive about this whole thing, is we are not others. We are part of this country, and we're not going to let that history be taken away from us.
And I think the other irony of it is that we are all Americans and we vote. And this group of people who have this mentality that these books shouldn't be studied are quickly becoming an ever-decreasing minority of voters in this country.
Yes, in fact, part of the caravan in two of the cities, we are having cultural caucuses, which what those are just a review of the school board, seeing when the seats are up for re-election. We're not telling anybody who to vote for. We are just trying to make people aware of what's happening, because that's really one of the main points, is these students are young. They are going to be 18 soon, and they need to be running for these school boards so that they do have a say in what happens in what they learn as they're growing up. You're right. It's been a very great experience so far. We left yesterday morning, and what's so amazing about all of this is all of the folks that we've talked to and the networking and how fired up people are getting, and not in a bad way. We're not, you know, I think we were on Democracy Now, actually. Tony Diaz, the founder of Nuestra Palabra and our director here, was on Democracy Now on Monday, and he said it best. It's not that they're afraid that we're going to take over violently in a revolutionary way. They're worried that we're going to start voting, and we are going to start getting them out in that way, getting them out of the legislature in that way by voting. They're not afraid of us revolting. They're afraid of us overhauling the government by voting, and that's what's going to happen.
Liana Lopez is producer and co-host of Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say on KPFT in Houston. And she is involved with Libro Traficante, which is on the web at librotraficante.com. And her show is on the web at nuestrapalabra.org. And I will link to those on my website, santafe.radiocafe.org. Liana, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for taking the time to have me on.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Linda Siegel, and she is with us with the legislative wrap-up. We do the legislative update during the 60 and 30-day legislative sessions, and we did that. And now let's look back on the session. The time for vetoes has come and gone. Vetoes have been made. Bills have been passed. Give us an overview of the 30-day New Mexico legislative session.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here to talk about this very exciting 30-day session. To remind everybody, we had about 1,000 bills, memorials, constitutional amendments introduced. And, of course, this is a 30-day session that's just required to be for the budget. But a lot of governors let other issues come on to the call, and so there were many, many things that legislators wanted to discuss. And if the governor had given a message even remotely related to that topic, bills got introduced, and that's why we've had so many. But the very interesting thing is that out of these 1,000-plus bills and memorials, only 77 actual bills passed, which is the lowest number in a 30-day session since 1976.
Really?
And that's fascinating. Now, not that passing a lot of bills is necessarily a good thing, because we seem to pass a lot of bills that aren't so good, but to only have 77 actually pass both chambers is unusual, to say the least.
To what do you attribute that?
I think partly because it was a 30-day session that is preceding the election, and people are really already out there deciding what they're going to do in their campaigns, and this is likely to be quite a partisan, perhaps very contentious election coming up. And I think that that just sort of put a pallor over it, and a lot of people just didn't want to pass very many bills.
So they were afraid that it would be used against them if they took a stand on something?
Well, we pretty much know that there will be a lot of that happening in the session, where Democrats will use things that Republicans said in the legislature and vice versa. And we know that the governor was taping a lot of the hearings, and perhaps some of those tapes will appear in campaign messages.
Videotapes?
Videotapes, right.
Did the Democrats ever get their stuff together to actually do any of their own taping?
I did not see any Democrats doing any tapings of hearings.
Anyway, okay. So shall we talk about the budget itself?
Right, which was the most important thing that the legislature passed.
And which is what the 30-day session is about.
Indeed. The budget did pass, a $5.6 billion budget, which is not anywhere near the 2007 budget high, where we had about a $6.2 billion budget. We did have an increase this year in revenues, so the legislature appropriated another $200 million or so to go to different programs. So this was an increase from last year's budget, which was around $5.4 billion, and a lot of programs that had been cut over the last 3 years got some funding put back in. Education had $89 million go back in. Medicaid had another $38 million allocated, and then a number of the safety net programs, domestic violence, child care, sexual assault, those kinds of programs got little increases, but nothing that brought any of them back to their pre-2007 levels.
Which is, okay, that's where they were in 2007, and one might make the argument that they weren't exactly overfunded at that point.
Absolutely not. Many, particularly the social services and health care programs.
Now, one of our themes for today is vetoes. Were there any budget vetoes?
Well, there were actually very few, which is kind of unusual. The best I could tell, I went through the budget, it looked like there was only about $2 million of vetoes out of about a $5.6 billion budget. Some interesting ones in Santa Fe. Women's Health Services had a $50,000 appropriation to help them. That was vetoed. And a program at the Linzig Theater for youth in theater for $100,000, that was vetoed. And obviously there were other small projects vetoed totaling about $2 million.
So what was that all about?
Oh, I don't know. Who can know? The governor doesn't have to give messages when they veto line items in the budget. Now, the bills that we'll talk about in a few minutes that were vetoed, the governor always gives a message about why she vetoed certain things.
And that's required?
It's customary. I don't know if it's required, but
okay. But
usually they give a veto message explaining why.
Well, let's talk about some of the bills that were passed. Of these, what, 77 bills?
Yes. And none of them are going to make people too excited. The bill that the governor really wanted was a tax pyramiding bill. In construction, people who are doing construction have to pay gross receipts tax on every level of purchase of products and services. And what this bill does, and this has been a bill of discussion for a number of years, and so it finally passed. What this bill does is does away with that pyramiding, that charging gross receipts tax at every level. And when it goes into effect fully by, I think, 2017, it will be about a $50 million hit to the coffers of the state. So it's a significant tax cut when it's fully implemented.
Give an example of what that actually looks like in real life.
Okay, so if I'm a contractor and I get a contract to build a new building at the community college, how about a higher education center at the community college? I have to pay gross receipts tax on the things, the materials that I purchase.
So you go buy some cement and some framing materials
and
some, okay.
Right, and then at the next level, I have to pay gross receipts tax to the people who, the subcontractors, I have to pay gross receipts, or they have to pay gross receipts tax.
So they charge you $10,000 plus 8 point whatever percent.
Right, right. And then anything that subcontractor buys, they have to pay gross receipts tax on. So you've got the one pot of money, let's say $10 million. Everybody you contract out to, then they have to also pay gross receipts tax on every single thing they buy, on every single service they purchase. And what this bill does is it takes it back down to paying one gross receipts tax.
And where does it get paid?
Well, it where probably would get paid in the original contractor. I'm not exactly clear how it works, but only one entity would pay the gross receipts tax, and then you don't have to pay it down through or up through all those other levels.
Right.
It's probably fairer that way, but it's certainly part of the issue is that in New Mexico, we rely heavily on revenues from gross receipts tax, and we do every year. We erode those gross receipts taxes by giving tax credits and tax abatements to different groups. And pretty soon, we're not going to have any gross receipts tax. And
and it's easy to take them away, and it's really hard to put them back.
That's right. And John Arthur Smith this session, who's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, did this joke bill where he said, we're just going to eliminate all gross receipts taxes in New Mexico. And the FIR, which is the fiscal impact report, was $2 billion.
Right.
So if we eliminated everything, that's how much money the state would lose out of our $5.6 billion budget. So
right.
It is significant.
Okay.
Okay, other bills that passed. One bill that St. Vincent's wanted very much was a sole community provider to allow money to come from other sources to help pay for indigent care throughout the state in all the different hospitals. So that was a positive bill. A bill changing child adoptions passed, making those more difficult for shysters so that people can't come in and say they're an adoption agency and then take people's money and then not have any children.
Does that happen?
Yes.
People come in and they get money and then they leave the kids that they were supposed to have adopted?
Or there are no kids to be adopted. I mean, it put a lot more restrictions penalties on people who aren't following the law, however that goes. A bill attempting to deal with some of the problems with opioid overdose, a pain management bill that passed.
What does it say?
Oh, it's an existing law, and it strengthens the existing councils the council that's supposed to address this problem and bring all the providers together and figure out how to do regulations that can help providers make sure they're not overprescribing. And it doesn't really address the illegal activity going on in the opioid business
which
world,
which is
selling on the streets and
right,
stealing.
Isn't that where most of the overdose problem comes from?
Yeah, from stealing from retail or wholesale, from getting drugs on the internet.
Yeah,
from another country, where there seems to be no control over that. And then a bill that's important to any business was the fix of the temporary unemployment fund contributions. And because we've had such high unemployment, our unemployment fund was getting precariously low. And this bill just assured that if we have to raise that, it will be the smallest amount possible. If we have to raise the unemployment tax to fill that fund back up, that it'll be as modest as possible and only occur when the fund really goes down. So, you know, lots of bills like that, which aren't all that exciting. We did a bill to change the legislative retirement contributions to increase the amount that legislators pay into that fund. Of course, we don't pay legislators any salary, but they do have a retirement fund, which certainly I think they deserve since they work all this time for no money.
Okay, we're talking to Linda Siegel with this year's legislative wrap-up. So bills that failed to pass. That's another category.
Yeah, and those are ones that were the most controversial in this legislative session. The fireworks ban. That bill died very early in the session.
I can't believe that.
It is kind of
with all those wildfires last year.
Right, and the ban was really just to allow the governor to declare that the state was in a disaster situation and that we should stop selling fireworks. But the fireworks lobby was quite powerful, and that bill died in, I think it was the Senate Corporations Committee, and that was the end of it.
The power of lobbyists, Linda Siegel.
Yes, the power of lobbyists.
I found a bunch of blown fireworks in the field near where I live, and they were, a few weeks ago, they were scaring all the dogs, and I found the blown out empty containers.
Oh, my gosh.
And I live right in the middle of Santa Fe. I mean,
wow.
There we have it.
Yep. Well, in a few months, we're really not going to want those out unless we get some more rain.
Yep.
Another hot bill was the teacher evaluation bill, and this was a piece of legislation that the governor had her bill, and then the Democrats had their version of the bill. And both of them were kind of moving along in the committees, but they could never get to the point where they merged them or made any kind of compromise. Consequently, both bills died in both the House and the Senate. So no new teacher evaluation. There are, of course, teacher evaluation plans already in effect. The third grade promotion bill, or the no third grade promotion if you can't read bill, again, the governor's version, the Democrats' version, and the two could just not get together, and so there was no compromise. Both bills, again, in the House and the Senate, they were moving along, and then when they couldn't get any compromise, that was the end. So those bills died, too.
You know, when you were here, I made a call out to our listeners who were mathematically inclined to send me the numbers on how long it would take if you didn't promote third graders for the state to be 50% third graders.
I remember that.
And nobody sent me anything. So I did the math myself. And it turns out, oddly enough, that if half fail every year, you still don't ever get to that point. It kind of levels out to where you always have big third grade classes, but the rest of the classes kind of even out after a period of 10 years. The first year, you've got very small fourth grades everywhere. But then the third grades become so big that if half of them pass, then your fourth grades are a normal size again after 10 years. So the thing that I expected actually doesn't happen.
But you will have to deal with multiple new classrooms of third graders if you implement this.
You will have big third grade classes.
Right, or many more of them. So there's room for coming to agreement on that, but didn't happen this session. Perhaps because it's 30 days. I think probably in the 60-day session that there'll be some agreement. And, of course, the one we've talked about and you've talked about a lot, the immigrant driver's license repeal bill. It did pass the House, and then it sat in the Senate, and the Senate passed its own version, which was not an outright repeal, but that made a lot stricter requirements, fingerprinting, you have to reapply every year, address verification, all kinds of things that address the fraud concern. But then the Senate bill never was heard in the House. So you had two different bills passing over to the other chambers and
so basically
died.
It goes back to what it was before, which is immigrants can get driver's licenses under the current program.
Yes.
You know, I was reading the other day in the paper, there was an article about a man back east. I think it was North Carolina, who was married. He's a Mexican guy. He was married to an American. They had three kids. They, whatever state he was, had had a bill where you could get a driver's license. It was repealed.
Mm-hmm.
He was a landscaper, and he was always driving to work. He couldn't get his license renewed. He didn't have enough money to apply for citizenship, and that, because it's a very lengthy and very expensive thing. So he hadn't done that yet. And not only was he deported from the United States, but he as it stands now, has lost all parental rights. His wife is mentally ill, can't take care of the kids. The kids were taken away and put into foster care.
Oh, my God.
And are being raised by strangers. And we all know the horror stories that come out of foster care. Not that these kids will necessarily live that. But this man who is a completely fit father, whose mm-hmm. only crime, and it's not even a crime, whose only violation was that his driver's license expired and he didn't have the proper documents, is in Mexico, ready to receive his own three small children, and the United States won't give them to him.
Wow.
And this is the kind of breaking up of families
yeah, right.
that comes about when you start doing things like the repeal, ladies
Absolutely.
And gentlemen.
Yes. Okay, on to the next bill, the ERB, the Education Retirement Board fix, which because the public school and higher education retirement fund has not enough money in it to pay everything out, they've got to make some fixes. And this was there were several bills addressing that. There was one that the House passed, and it went over to the Senate and didn't get out of there. So we're going another year without fixing the education retirement problem. Spaceport liability, people probably heard a lot about that. The businesses at the spaceport wanted the state to eliminate them from any liability. And a bill was introduced to do that. And, of course, it was killed immediately in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And the governor's office is very concerned about that. And then the final one, which got a lot of publicity, was the land-grant permanent fund for education and for early education, and that bill failed in the House Education Committee, and then the Senate version never got out of the Senate. So those were some of the prominent ones that failed.
Right.
And never got to the governor.
Now let's talk about bills that were passed and then were vetoed by the governor.
Yes, and there were 14, I think, of those, but the ones that are the most controversial, probably the one that is the most controversial that she vetoed, was Senate Bill 9, which was the corporate income tax that Senator Peter Wirth has been working on for 8 or 9 years now. And this version of the bill lowered the corporate income tax by 0.5 percentage point for everybody and required that combined reporting that we talk about for the larger corporations. And of course, his messaging has been that we treat big corporations from out of state much better than we treat our local New Mexico corporations in the income tax arena. And he's been trying to equalize that for years.
Well, so if you are Walmart, you pay lower taxes than if you are a mom and pop shop selling the same stuff.
Percentage wise, yes.
Yeah.
So that bill was vetoed, and the governor's message on that was that, oh, it was unfair to these large corporations, and that people would be laid off, and companies, grocery stores, clothing stores, all would start charging more money to consumers, and that would have an adverse effect on New Mexicans and all that.
Well,
all those reasons.
Yeah, a lot of outcry about that. Any other vetoed bills you want to mention?
Well, an interesting one was the increase for county salaries, and that would have any county elected official, county commissioners, treasurer, clerk, they would have gotten an increase. She vetoed that. And a bill that would, a criminal expungement bill, and what that bill did was if somebody stole your identity and then they went out and committed crimes with your identity, the police are going to come after you and you're probably going to get arrested. And then you have to say, well, wait, that wasn't me, my identity was stolen. But your arrest is still going to stay on your record, even though it wasn't you. And this bill would have helped that by removing the record of those illegitimate arrests.
And she vetoed that?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Well, there were some other things in it, too, like if you had a misdemeanor and you hadn't gotten any trouble for 10 years, that would be removed. But all of her cabinet, the public safety...
Like public swearing or something?
Well, that could be like a domestic violence that got pled down to a misdemeanor. It could be anything. But the public safety secretary testified against it, and part of their reasoning was, well, it will be a a nightmare to figure out how our systems will address taking certain people out and leaving others in. And you know, it's bureaucratic. And so people who are unfairly charged, their names will remain in the system, and some won't be able to get jobs and all that, all the bad things that happen from that.
Oh, boy.
So that was vetoed. And then a few others, but those were the more interesting ones.
Now, as we always talk about every year, there's capital outlay, and some of the capital outlay that was passed was also vetoed.
Yes, there were two, what we would call the GO bond capital outlay, which is statewide bonds that that we all will have to vote on in the general election. And that was, I think, about $230 million. She did not line item veto anything there. And that's a lot of statewide projects, higher education institutions, those kinds of things. But the actual capital, the severance tax capital outlay bill, was about $150 million, I think. And she vetoed $22.9 million
oh, boy.
Out of that bill. And Santa Fe had $3.3 million of that. She vetoed the courthouse, the equipment, the furniture, those things that our brand-new courthouse downtown is going to need.
We're going to stand.
The judges are going to be sitting on folding chairs, I guess. So the $1.2 million vetoed from that.
And then Why?
I don't know. I do not know. I think her comment on that was that the county should pay for that. And the county has said, well, we don't have any more money, so we can't pay for that. And then she vetoed things like $200,000 for the Santa Fe Farmers Market to redo one of their parts of the building. Of course, the city of Santa Fe owns the Santa Fe Farmers Market building, and this would have improved that building, enabling more economic development. And she vetoed the $200,000 for the Santa Fe Botanical Gardens to
Is she mad at Santa Fe?
It could be.
We probably didn't vote for her.
So there were quite a few, $3.3 million of Santa Fe things vetoed. Parking lots for the schools, a phone system for the schools, that was vetoed. Women's health services, $130,000 to improve their building, which is owned by the county, which
does indigent care. They got nailed twice.
Yeah, so they lost the capital outlay, and then they lost some operating money. And then other counties, of course, Doñana County lost $2.6 million. Bernalillo County lost $5 million.
And so what happens? Okay, so you pass a budget, and the budget has all that money in it, and then it's vetoed. Does that mean we have a surplus of all those millions?
Yes, that means there'll be $22.9 million available in the 60-day session to add to next year's allocation.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, capital outlay, we've talked about this on the show for years. There are these differing philosophies. A lot of legislators want to be able to fund projects in their own area which have economic development impact for their area. But then a lot of governors want to have these big statewide projects. Like $30 million of this capital outlay went for the Big I in Albuquerque. Well, absolutely they need that. But we also, a lot of us think we need the local projects to help our local communities and to help the businesses and programs and wherever we live.
Now, there are some bills that were passed or whatever these things are called that result in not being signed or vetoed or whatever, but rather in being put on the ballot as constitutional amendments.
Yes, constitutional amendments. And there were four of those that actually passed. Three of them had to do with the PRC.
Yes.
So the first
one. The Public Regulation Commission.
Yes, Public Regulation Committee, which has been in the news so much in the last years.
Right.
Not just with our own local commissioner being indicted and convicted, but others that have served in the Public Regulation Commission. And so one of the first constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot is creating some qualifications, some educational qualifications for anyone who wants to run for the PRC. And we do this in other areas, like the attorney general has to be an attorney. The treasurer, I think, has to have, you know,
some
kind of accounting background. So it's not that unusual. The putting the corporations part, you know, if you're a for-profit or non-profit corporation, you have to register and file with the state corporations, which is in the PRC, moving that to the Secretary of State's office. And then the third one, the superintendent of insurance is in the PRC, and that's been a political football, that position, with different people being appointed depending on who the PRC commissioners are, and that would be appointed by an outside commission if this constitutional amendment were to pass. And then the fourth one was one that I've never thought of before, but creating an independent public defender. Right now, the public defender, the director of the public defender office is appointed by the governor. And this would allow a commission made up of different people to appoint the public defender.
And what's behind that?
The feeling that the public defender's office was not getting full funding, didn't have an independent advocate that could go to the legislature, that it was totally controlled by whomever the governor is. So this would make that independent. And so those four constitutional amendments will be on the ballot. Plus, there were some constitutional amendments from last session which will be on the general election ballot. It's really important for people to look at those constitutional amendments before they go to vote, because it will just have a few words describing it, and if you haven't looked at it beforehand, you're not going to know what those amendments are really about.
Maybe we'll talk about them on this show.
Yes, let's do that before the election.
Before the election.
Yes.
So we've got just about 2 minutes left.
There's one other important thing to mention.
Okay.
The Senate confirms all the department secretaries. And every secretary that the governor has appointed has been confirmed by the Senate except one, and that's the Education Secretary, Hannah Scandera. And this time she didn't get a confirmation hearing. So she is still an acting secretary without confirmation. Of course, she could be acting for the next 2 years.
Right. So there's a primary election coming up in June. What's at stake? What will we be voting for then?
Well, this legislative session, as I said earlier, was really all about this election coming up. And there are a lot of empty seats with retiring senators and retiring House members. Also, the redistricting created about 10 new swing districts that can go either Democrat or Republican. That means that these are going to be very contentious and interesting elections coming up. And so it's really important for people, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, to...
Or something else.
Or, well, if you're an independent or a Green, you
That's
have
true,
no
can.
Primary election, and we don't have crossovers. So, but if you're one of the, quote, major parties, then get involved in your primary election, because a lot of seats are decided in the primary, and with seats opened up because incumbents like Representative Ben Lujan is retiring, so that seat is open in the Democratic primary.
And Mayor Koss is running
and
for that
he
seat.
He is, and there's someone else running in that seat, and there may be more people running in that seat. So that's a seat that will be determined by the primary election. So if you want to have a voice in who your representative is or your senator and the elections in the primary, get out there and vote. And our turnouts are notoriously low.
I know.
We don't have a presidential fight in the Democratic Party. They do in the Republican Party. So a lot of people don't go out and vote in the primary unless there's a presidential candidate. But these House and Senate seats are really important.
Linda Siegel is with us during every legislative session doing the legislative update, and this has been the legislative wrap-up. So maybe we'll see you a little before the primary in June.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that.
Excellent. Linda Siegel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.